Hello, everyone. I'm joined here today with Anthony Mikkels from the Netherlands. It's nice having you back on the show.
Thanks, Robert.
So I guess where we can start off is we can talk about your trip to Ireland. That's not your most recent article, but I think that would be a good place to start.
Okay. Well, I visited Ireland twice this year, in the summer and in the autumn. And both times I met up with some people there to discuss monetary reform, both on a national level and on a local level, in the sense of regional currencies, which I think are very important. Well, especially the second trip showed quite an upsurge in interest in monetary reform in general, I think. And Ellen Brown was there the second time. She was a speaker at an event that I also attended and spoke at. And I met her then, and the first trip in Dublin led to a meeting with Bill Still on the airport, at Dublin Airport. And that was, for me, it was a bit of a landmark. And you know that I'm in Holland, and it's not so easy to meet up. And twice Dublin showed to be halfway between America and Europe. And yeah, I enjoyed it.
So is it Public Banking of Ireland is the name of the organization?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. By James Miller. So, that was the organization that brought Ellen over, and obviously Ellen is very much involved in view of her public banking initiative, and with the idea that nationalizing banking would basically solve the problem, or the issues that we face, and basically Jim Miller was also promoting the idea of a public bank, which obviously is much better than these vultures that nowadays are in control of our finances. So,
So you talk about the situation in Ireland, and you said it was in the news that there are 10 to 12 people kill themselves in Ireland every week.
It is incredible, and Ireland is a very small country, and only 4 million people, and over the last few years, more than 300,000, especially young and bright people, left the country, which is obviously an incredible brain drain and an enormous tax on the future of the country, and very much like what Ireland has been going through over the last century until in the mid-90s, things finally started to pick up there. Only 100 years ago, maybe 150 years ago, Ireland had about 8 million people, and it's been a slave first to Britain and later to the banks ever since.
And the other thing that's happening in Ireland, you pointed out, is it's being flooded by immigrants from all over the world. And it's increasing the crime there, and it's putting a lot of pressure on their social services.
Absolutely, and this is obviously a major problem throughout Western Europe and the Northwest in particular, also in the South actually, with all the immigrants from Africa coming. And it's putting an incredible pressure both on national cohesion, as can be expected, and of course as was intended, because mass immigration is a money power due plutocratic kind of assault on national unity, on also even on racial integrity. Of course, I mean it's very popular to perhaps to suggest that, but that is also a part of the picture, obviously. Western culture is really very much on the threat of mass immigration, and so is Ireland. Like I said, it's a small country, and basically in terms of the center of the country, obviously, is Dublin. It's the only big city in entire Ireland, except maybe a little bit Cork. But almost half of the people are in Greater Dublin. And, yeah, you see a lot of immigrants there. And, yeah, it's the same in all major Western Europe cities where it's more and more becoming a melting pot.
And you point out what are some of the main reasons why the plutocrats promote immigration.
Yeah, because they want us to murder each other, and they want to dilute national identity. They also want to destroy the tribal nature of the countries in Africa and the Middle East. I think especially a man like Morris has done a lot to expose this, and then I think that's a really very important part of the story, that these tribes are being destroyed with all sorts of stupid wars, whether it's Libya or Algeria, what is happening in the Middle East, or now going down in Mali, in the north of Nigeria. It's all destabilization, the destruction of long-standing tribal arrangements. These people are sent to the West, where they are infected with Western materialism, pornography, and what have you, and the West itself is being destroyed by this immigration.
And the other thing you point out in Ireland is the real estate market there. And the mortgages.
Yeah, but let me finish the last thing, because I had another thing came to mind, Robert, which I think is very important. And we are in this credit crunch, and this is a very long-term, very well-planned money power operation. This credit crunch that we have been going through over the last 5 years is a long-standing plan in the decapitation of the West as the dominant power in the world, and especially the US, but to a lesser extent Europe too. And this credit crunch, which is a collusion by the state, by banking, the EU, and a couple of lesser entities, this resistance against this is also very much diluted by mass immigration. And these things are absolutely not an accident. In fact, immigration in Holland started in the late 60s, and it was only a few years before the big post-war boom was about to end. And they must have foreseen that, of course. And long-standing policy of deindustrialization, especially in the United States, where the entire manufacturing base is being outsourced. Obviously, they expected resistance against this. And I think this is a very important part of the larger picture. And then about this real estate issue in Ireland, it's a prototype. It's a textbook example of how these things are managed and how things go. And what you see on the one hand is a premeditated campaign by the banks to provide low-cost credit on the housing market. And they create an incredible boom with that. And, you know, real estate goes through the roof. The other side of the coin is that the people go nuts. And they start telling each other that this is a wonderful new era and a new economy. And this is going to last till eternity. And this is what happens always with these asset bubbles. And they think I'm going to be a millionaire too. They went on board with this. In the end game of the whole nightmare, all over Ireland, they were opening up golf courses where you could, where membership cost about 30,000 euros and things like that. And people were buying second, third houses, cars, whatever. And obviously this was going to go awry, and it did. And I think that is also part of the hangover that Ireland is now experiencing. They're going through some sort of a atonement with themselves, and that's why they accept the whip of the government and the banking industry, which has been destroying the country with austerity.
And what is this thing in Ireland? Is that they say there's something called the usury free network that gives out the winged lion award, the winged lions award.
No, this is in North America, and
in Ireland. This is something different.
Yeah, this is America. Yeah.
So the winged lion was the symbol of the Venetian Empire.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but you know, there was also I later realized this. There is also a good example of a well-run Venetian bank that actually served both people and the empire very well. And I think that this is what the winged lion actually alludes to in terms of. Of the Winged Lion awards, which are being distributed or handed out by the Usury Free Network, because Venice, for me and for many other people, is also associated with early banking in the late Middle Ages in Italy, and which later morphed into Western capitalism, which arose in Amsterdam and London. That story.
So you're saying that your view is saying of the Venetian Empire, you're saying it's a positive view.
No, I'm saying that there was a Venetian bank, but...
But was it was a usury-based bank or not?
No, I think it was usury-free at the time, and it was basically actually gold-based, but they had plenty of gold to circulate at a low cost, and there was later a paper that was even circulating at a higher value than gold, and this was all positive in many ways, but Venice also, of course, is known for its merchant class and its banking class that later turned into the black nobility and what have you. So it's a mixed picture.
And in this article about Ireland, you talk about Jason Erb, who was a speaker in Toronto at a usury free event. And you interesting you because I've actually met Rodney Martin. Did you have a debate with him?
I'm going to have this debate. It was twice cancelled, first from his side and then from my side. But we are going to meet up for a debate.
Where is that going to take place, or is that secret?
It's going to be just online via Skype. Or when do you mean?
Okay, well, when is it going to be and where is it going to be hosted?
Well, Jason Earp will host it, and it is not clear yet when it will be, but it will be in the coming weeks.
I'll let you explain this in detail, but to kind of simplify it for people who are kind of dumbed down, I guess, is that Rodney Martin is basically taking a pro-Hitler stance, and you're taking the anti-Hitler stance.
Well, if you put it...
Yeah, to really simplify it for the people who are dumbed down, but it's a lot more complex than that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, if you put it that way, I'll go along with that.
So basically, it's about the debate's going to be about the banking system in the Third Reich, because there is just so many different views out there. On one hand, you have the Alex Jones type that they were a puppet of the Illuminati. But then the other hand, you get the people who are very supportive, who support that regime. So your view is you have a totally unique take on this.
Well, I think I introduced something new to the perception of Hitler because I think what is very important at this point in the truth movement is a revisionist view of Hitler, and many people are now coming more and more, and on an amazing scale actually, people are coming to terms with the Holocaust, which is obviously a major item. And also of the ridiculous idea that Hitler was some sort of a total idiot, a total evil, versus, the democracy of the West. I mean, this is a horrible, this is basically just Allied wartime propaganda. And Hitler faced complete maniacs in Washington and especially London, and of course in Moscow. And the idea that Hitler was the sole cause of the war or particularly bad, I mean, compared to Churchill, I think that Hitler was an angel, you know. So, I don't really think that. I mean, he was. My point of view is that he was no worse and no better than the others.
So you're taking a nuanced view in between the people who say he was the worst person in history or the people who say he was a total saint. You're saying there's a nuanced view in between.
Exactly, and my view of Hitler is that I don't think he was a total puppet of the enemy, but I do think that they purposefully allowed him to build up because they wanted him to build up against Stalin, and they wanted war with Stalin, and they wanted destruction of Germany, and Hitler gave him just this, and I think that Hitler was partly aware of this too. Especially later in his reign, especially maybe say in the early 40s, he must have realized what the situation actually was. Because Hitler, for some reason, Hitler thought that he would make a deal with Britain, and that is very clear in history. And everybody that thinks clearly about Hitler must ask himself, how could Hitler have been so foolish as to think that he would have gotten a deal with Britain? Because Britain is the absolute core of Jewish rule in the world, of the money power. It is there where the bankers conquered both the world through New York and Moscow. And Hitler must have known this. And the idea that he thought that he could have peace with the British Empire is amazing.
You admire the economist Gottfried Feder, and you point out that he was actually sidelined.
Yes, and Gottfried Feder was basically the man behind the very strong anti-usury statements that Hitler made, especially in the years that he was getting ready to take power in Germany. It is basically Feder and his, well, propaganda, but I don't mean this in a negative way, because I'm absolutely convinced that Feder was completely honest about this issue, and he was very passionate about this, and very knowledgeable also. He was a little bit too much for the industrial backers that were very important in bringing Hitler to power. There are very clear indications that in the early 30s, first in 1931, but especially during the Night of the Long Knives, that he was forced, that he was sidelined basically, and that especially after Hitler came into power, he gave the Reichsbank presidency to Hjalmar Schacht, and not to Gottfried Feder, which is obviously very important.
You never talk about this really on your blog that I'm aware of, but what is the role that the Strasser brothers played in this?
To be honest, Robert, I really wouldn't know. What I have seen from Federer's career is that you know that ultimately he was not influential enough to implement his policies, and Hitler went with another line and another man. But what the Strasser brothers, what their role in all this really was, I don't have the knowledge.
So one last thing about National Socialism is you obviously, I mean, someone like yourself, a lot of your opponents are going to call you a fascist and whatnot. But I think the key aspect of National Socialism is that there is a tremendous concentration of power, and you're basically a decentralist, and the key thing is that political power and economics has to be decentralized, and the National Socialist system was very much the opposite of that. Power was extremely concentrated in the hands of a few. So in that sense, it was actually like communism and modern capitalism in that sense.
Very much so, and I think that this is the crucial issue when we really want to evaluate National Socialism as an experiment. Then this is a key issue, and what I represent is, it's like you said, decentralism, and especially the end of usury and the end of the feudalism of money. And this is a key thing, but not by consolidating that power in the state, because that is what they then call socialism. And we want that power to be devolved to the common man, and every man and woman must have his fair share in the commons, and not some plutocracy or a strong state that monopolizes everything.
Yeah, and you have this article that says that socialism is not the answer to capitalism, and they're basically socialism and capitalism. They're basically the same in the sense that they're both monopolies.
That is absolutely, to my mind, the absolute core of the whole thing. They want a complete consolidation of power and wealth and everything, and both socialism and capitalism give them this. And the difference is, you know, of the narrative is that capitalism, the core issue of capitalism, to my mind, is the idea of return on investment, and this is expressed in the usury. But the idea that money must breed money, and investing in other people's projects should give you a return. This is the basic issue, and this leads to all sorts of redistributions from those who don't have capital but have labor and the money, to the few who have capital. And this is why capital is the bottleneck in the production, and this is why capital is artificially scarce and expensive, and this is why it concentrates this power in so few hands, and usury is of course key in all this. Usury is the ultimate centralizer of wealth. And this massive monopoly of all the banks, all the transnational companies, but also the land holdings that they have, and the mineral wealth, and all this is consolidated in one big capitalist monopoly, and they want to move on to some sort of world government, and this then should be a massive global state, and they want to consolidate all this private wealth and associated power in a massive state. This is exactly what socialism is. Obviously, this will leave the commoner completely bereft of any personal sovereignty, which is what I think is what is it which you should be really all about.
Yeah. So in order to have a society of a small and medium-sized businesses rather than the large corporate monopolies, usury is the key to that, getting rid of usury.
Absolutely, for many reasons, but the basic idea is this. Transnationals could really not exist in a usury-free economy because there's the basic law of economics. The number one law of economics is he with the lowest cost of capital wins. And the fact is that transnational corporations, they have access to a lot of credit. They have access to several forms of credit, capital, money, and shares, and all sorts of bonds, and all sorts of financial instruments that normal people do not have access to. But also, within the transnational business itself, there are production chains, and these production chains are, you know, they are financed with what I would call concern, with basically credit by bookkeeping within the transnational itself. And this allows, and this is the basic thing, this allows these transnationals to finance their production interest-free to a large extent. Small and medium-sized businesses, they work also together in production chains, but these are financed with dollars or with euros, and these are heavily taxed with usury and therefore very expensive and also hard to come by because you need to go to a bank to get all this money. And this gives the transnational such a major advantage, and this is why you always see that the transnational wants to get as much of the production chain within its own corporate structure as possible, because the longer the production chain, the more, the longer the interest-free financing that they can provide for the chain. And this is also a little understood issue, but this gives the transnational corporations such a massive head start in any market, and this is the real reason why they are so successful ultimately. Again, like you said, without usury, this wouldn't happen, because then without usury, small and medium-sized business would have all the credit at very low cost that they would ever need. And this would create a level playing field, and then small and medium business would simply ravage all these transnationals because they are very inefficient in all the other ways that you can consider, for instance, with their large corporate headquarters structures and all this going on.
Part of the reason, and it is very hard to start for someone to start up a small business, is the issue of getting a loan.
Yeah, there is no access to capital, and the capital that you can get is very expensive, and this is really punitive to small and medium-sized business.
You talked about Austrian economics a while back, and you talked about Ed Griffin, who wrote The Creature of Jeff from Jekyll Island, and you were critical of him for not discussing usury, but you mentioned that he basically admitted to the role of usury recently, is what you're getting at.
Yeah, about 2 years ago I wrote this article, Who is Ed Griffin? Indeed, with a very critical, almost hostile tone of voice. But I feel very strongly about these issues because, to me, it's very very difficult to understand how serious people can really suggest gold as money, and especially if you look at this book, The Creature of Jekyll Island.
So he admits that the bankers own all the gold.
Yeah, because that was my basic critique, or one of my basic critiques, because, you know, that's the first thing that, of course, anybody with any knowledge of real history thinks of, all these gold standards of the past that were dominated by the same banks that rule today. Obviously, the gold is completely in the hands of the bank. How can somebody really talk about liberty and freedom when, etc.? And now recently, some Austrian outlet, they interviewed him and they discussed this article. At Griffin, then, really, I was pretty amazed to hear all this, but he admitted, completely, that the bankers owned all the gold. The only consolation that he had for us was that 99% of all the gold is not dug up, and we can open some new mines, according to Ed Griffin, to get some gold of our own, because, that's what he then sees as a plausible way of going forward.
So he still, he doesn't repudiate the gold standard.
Not at all, but earlier he did vehemently deny that the bankers owned all the gold.
But you were talking about brother Nathaniel Kapner, and we don't really need to talk about the sort of the cult of personality behind him per se. We can talk about the ideas. But he used to be a hardcore supporter of Ron Paul and Austrian economics, and he recently repudiated that.
Yeah, that was a really remarkable thing, and a great show, because he made a couple of vids and for his YouTube channel, and he basically denounced Ron Paul's economics, especially the gold standard and the austerity. And this was a bit of a turnabout for him, because, like you said, he was a strong supporter of Ron Paul, and many in the alternative media obviously were. One of the key issues that everybody has been overlooking is that this Austrian economics is, of course, with this gold standard, a complete disaster, because, like we were just saying, all the gold is in the hands of the bankers, and this is exactly what they want. Nathaniel, brother Nathaniel, he did the great thing of admitting that this was a bit of that something that this needed to be addressed, and he then went on to make another video saying that monetary reform is the mother of all reform. Now thinking clearly in terms of the Treasury creating some money of its own and not being dependent on the banks. well, this was an incredible move forward. And then all of a sudden, a few weeks later, he just took them all down. Well, I thought this was pretty shocking, and I was actually elated to see somebody to just admit, hey, we made a mistake with Ron Paul, and let's move on, and let's focus on this crucial issue of money, because if there is one message that I have with real currencies, Robert, I think that much is clear, is that in monetary reform and usury is, without that, we have nothing. We can talk about everything else, but without getting money right, we have absolutely nothing. And that should be the basic message, I think, when dealing with banking cartel that rules the world.
You've been touching this article. You have this article, Rationalizing Usury, the Time Value Hoax. Can you explain what the time value hoax is?
Yeah. A time value is the basic argument that everybody uses for usury, because it is worth more to have a dollar today than tomorrow, because between today and tomorrow there will be inflation, and there will also be the missed investment opportunity for the lender. So this then gives money what they call a time value, and this is then the classical rationale for usury always, and it is at the core of modern economic theory, or classical economic theory also, by the way. Absolutely fallacious, because basic fact is that the banks print all the money that they lend out. And clearly, when they create the credit, when you go into debt, and when the associated money is retired from circulation, when the debt is repaid, the bank does not win anything with this money creation, other than the fact that it can slap usury on it and charge 5% or even more per year for it, and which amounts to all these dreadful costs that we pay every day. Without time value, when money is created and then retired, obviously there is no time value, and then there's also no rationale for interest on the money, and therefore we can create this credit interest free for people. And this is the key issue. But even if you look at savers, because one of the key issue obviously is that people do not add 1 + 1, namely that there is money creation, that there is interest, and that one of the two must go. Not money creation, but it is usury that must go. But even if you talk about savers and people saving money and then lending it out and then saying, hey, I can't use the money during the time that I lent it out, this basically does not add up, because a saver does not want to spend his money anyway. Otherwise, he's not saving. He's wanting to use this money later. And if you want to use it later, why not lend it out in the meantime, in the time that you do not want to use it for the time being? And these are the basic problems with the time value story. And the rationale in itself, it does have a very tiny little bit of merit. You know, obviously, there are downsides to lending out really safe money. There is no downside to lending out freshly created money. But with the saving story, okay, it is not as clear-cut as the other example. But, you know, compared to the enormous cost that usury adds up to yearly, with all these trillions that are being redistributed from the many to the very few, then we must consider this complete hoax and completely irrelevant compared to the enormous damage that usury is doing.
And you talk about you write about the inconvenience to millionaires, and many people they have difficulty seeing the inequity of usury, and because people don't see themselves as poor, they're basically raised to believe that if they work hard, they'll succeed.
Yeah, that's the whole story, and we think it's a level playing field because we think, I wouldn't lend it if I didn't get interest, and we all hope, or maybe not all of us, but many of us hope to become rich, and then when we are rich, that we can live from the income that our money will be giving us. And this is basically everybody's dream. And as long as we keep dreaming that, I mean, we won't see that we are actually the ones that are paying all this money, because we are not wealthy and we are not going to be wealthy. Only very talented, hardworking people can escape being born as one of the masses and without privilege. And only if you have a lot of talent and a lot of ambition can you escape that. That's the clear fact of life. And this is given only a few. But this is a club and we're not part of it. And we should really start realizing this and start realizing there is not going to be a future where I'm going to be rich and everybody else is paying, even if that should be what we should be desiring, because obviously, why do we want to enslave other people with usury? We've got to grow over that, especially because we will mostly be paying usury, and we should be thinking, how do we get rid of this? How do we get rid of this $300,000 interest on my mortgage for a $200,000 house? Why can't I get credit for it to start up a business? And why must I pay up to 10% for a business loan? And these are the questions that matter. And people should get rid of this mistaken notion that they will strike it rich once and all will be well.
Yeah, I mean, you have someone like Peter Schiff, and he's saying people just need, all they need to do is they need to save more money. So we have, so there's an incentive for the higher interest rates. But he basically, what's happening is people are losing basically half their income to usury, and he just doesn't. He's just saying that all you need to do is people need to learn how to save more, but doesn't address that.
Yeah, and it's once you're caught in this quagmire, and once you're part of the masses toiling away, then it's very hard to get out of it because of this usury. And the more higher the interest rates go, the more money the poor will be paying on this all this usury. And how are they going to save then, even if they can't even save today? So these are typically the stories that the apologists of the rich parrot in front of the mainstream media, and it, you know, people they don't get it, they don't see through all these lies, because they don't understand how the money system really works and how it's usually redistributes.
So you point out that it's the poorest 80% are paying up to $10 trillion in usury per year globally to the richest 10%. And that the 1% now owns 43% of all assets of the world, while the poorest 80% owns only 10%.
Yeah, and this is the whole thing. The many pay to the few, and the rich lend and the poor borrow, and all this has been quantitatively analyzed by some people in Germany. And they came to these conclusions that you just mentioned, and the 80% are paying the 10%, and most of this money going to the 10% is actually going to the 1%. And the 1%, according to the official big figures, because obviously these are fairly mainstream figures, and I wonder if it is not even worse, the wealth distribution is atrocious, and it's much worse than most people realize, and very much worse than people think should be how it all be divided.
And this article right here is more on inflation, the value of money, and money as part of the commons. Can you explain what you mean by money as part of the commons?
Yeah, the idea is that we are so brainwashed to believe that money is scarce, and that money is, nobody knows where money is coming from. Okay, nowadays with the internet we realize there is that the banks create the money. But even then, we don't really realize what the implications of this really are. And what is really happening is that the bank creates credit, and it then goes on to say, hey, this is our credit, and you are going to pay us for it. But this credit is created by double-entry bookkeeping, and in double-entry bookkeeping, you have credit and debit, and this is automatic. This is the very nature of double-entry bookkeeping. The banks privilege, because they have usurped our credit. Basically, they are just our bookkeepers. They are just keeping the scores of all the actors in the economy, of their liabilities and et cetera, vis-a-vis the other players in the economy. And this is basically what a bank does. And the idea that they should be paid interest on this bookkeeping is completely absurd if you realize what is going on. And this is what people need to realize also, that the bank is absolutely not a real lender in the real sense of the word. They are creating all this credit, and this credit is just basically mutual credit between all of us. It is our promise to pay that is the basis for the bank to create the credit in the first place, and we accept this from each other. And because we do so, we all have credit because we accept each other's credit. And this is the true nature of money. And therefore, money exists as a function of the community, not as a function of some banker or some plutocrat or some whatever. It is a function of the community. And it is our agreements to use it as a means of exchange that actually makes it money because of the very definition of money. And therefore, our agreement to use it as a means of exchange makes it automatically a part of our common heritage, our common cooperation, our common being, and obviously this should not be taxed for usury. This should be made available at cost price to its rightful owner, being you and me.
And back to the article I touched on about you wrote about socialism. The problem is not private property. The problem is too much private property in too few hands. And that really is the key. It's not so much whether the property is privately or publicly owned, it's whether how it's distributed to as many people as possible.
Yeah, and especially also to the rightful people, the people that create, the laborers, they should be able to enjoy the fruits of their own labor, and they should not be unfairly taxed with these capital gains. And if you do this, then there is no need to redistribute anything via the state. And it is absolutely not unfair to the rich, because why it is unfair that the rich get paid for nothing now, whereas we cannot create all this credit interest free. And we should leave the added value of the production of the laborer with the real producer being the men and women that work away every day. And that's what real monetary reform is all about in that respect. And stopping the redistribution makes the redistribution through the state from the rich back to the poor unnecessary and superfluous. And you don't, Marxism and all these statist solutions like regulation and blah, 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 and the welfare state, these are workarounds and they are palliating the wounds, so to speak.
Yeah, the thing with the welfare state is the left says that the welfare state is the best thing in the world, and the right wing says the welfare state is the worst thing in the world. But the welfare state is not really, it's neither the greatest thing or the worst thing, it's merely a symptom.
Exactly, and the real welfare state that we have now is usury, this up to 10 trillion that is redistributed from the 80% of the world to the richest 10%. That is the real welfare state today, but the welfare state that we speak of in a normal sense is basically one of these, dressing the wounds and workarounds and dancing about around the bush and keeping things more or less bearable for those that lose most in the system, being the poorest, because the poorest pay the largest percentage of their income to usury. This is an even more depraved aspect of usury. So this welfare state is, and Marxism in general, and this idea of socialism, namely consolidating private monopoly into a state monopoly, so-called because this private property is the problem. No, the monopoly of private property is the problem. And we need to stop the redistribution, and then we don't need a big state, a big communist, Marxist, leftist, progressive redistribution scheme back to the poor again.
So we can have a smaller decentralized government, but the libertarian is primarily flawed, because under libertarianism, the corporate state would just surpass the public state.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. Libertarianism sounds great, but their policies, if you look closely at them, they are about as attractive to plutocracy as you can imagine. Their monetary policies are really atrocious. They're pro-austerity, pro-deflation, pro-gold, pro-private monopoly in the so-called free market, etc., etc., etc. And they're basically, their real economic policies, they lead to liberty for the rich and not for the many.
What is the difference between a debt-free money and interest-free credit?
Debt-free money is just money that is printed by the state, then either spent by the state itself or doled out to the public so that they can spend it in circulation. The latter is known as social credit, the first is known as a greenback or the continental. This money is just printed and then spent in circulation, and it can continue to circulate until it is taxed by the government. But then, of course, the government can spend it back into circulation again. And this creates an eternally circulating money supply, debt-free. And this is often mentioned because nowadays we hear about fractional reserve banking all the time, and we hear it's banks create all the money, and then we think this is unfair that they have this money creation ability, because we are, after all, paying interest on all this money. So But on the other hand, what the banks do show is that you can create all the credit that you will ever need, and that you can base a money supply on credit. But it is rather unfair that they ask 5% per year for it. That is a real issue. So the banks show that we can have interest-free credit too, and this is indeed the case. We can have a completely interest-free credit-based money supply as an alternative to debt-free money, solving the problem of usury on the money. Of course, not solving debt because the money is credit-based after all, but the question is that so bad really? For instance, a mortgage, if you want to buy a house, if you can get an interest-free mortgage, that would be a very worthy reason to go into debt.
Still debt, but debt without interest is not as necessarily as bad. So you would prefer an interest strike over debt repudiation.
Yeah, because I think interest-free credit is basically, at this point, better than debt-free money because it's more flexible. Interest-free credit can be created every time again that the debt is repaid, and debt-free money can be spent in circulation only once. And it's also a given that in a modern economy, it's almost unthinkable that we can do without credit. We will need debt, therefore, and it's very important that we can provide interest-free ways of going into debt. And this can be done with interest-free credit. And you know, the real issue then is not the debt, because it is plausible that for certain reasons that we go into debt, whether it's business loans, mortgages, things like that, real solid reasons. But the usury is the problem, and therefore an interest strike, responding to your question now, an interest strike is therefore, to my mind, also more on target than debt repudiation. In many respects anyway, for instance, in the case of a mortgage where a real house was gotten there, so can you repudiate a debt in exchange for which you got a real house? That to me is not so clear. Well, it's actually clear that is not so realistic. But an interest strike saying we are not going to stand for this usurious practice while you create all the money out of nothing, that goes to the real heart of the issue, and therefore an interest strike is. And actually, to be honest, we have every right now, today, to do just that. Just say, I'm not going to pay up for this interest anymore, knowing that you create all this credit out of nothing.
And you talk about the causes and effects of money scarcity, and that is one thing about Austrians, is they deny money scarcity. And obviously, gold as a source is a scarce resource. And you also, you talk about William Jennings Bryan's and his famous speech.
Yeah, money scarcity is, besides usury, the other really very important and profound issue, and it's also the main issue that American populism throughout the last 150 years of opposition to banking has always focused on, money scarcity. The simple fact is there's not enough money in circulation to have a fully blown, a really fully functioning economy, and this money scarcity is caused to a large extent by usury, because as many people today realize, the money is created, the principal is created, but the interest is not. And because of that, there is never enough money to pay off the debt plus interest. And this creates eternal money scarcity in a usurious money system, whether it's gold or paper, that does not matter at all. This money scarcity is really, really very important and permanently depressing our economies and making the rich richer, because those holding money are much favored by money scarcity, and these obviously are the rich. This has always been the main issue of American populism, and William Bryant, he then made this famous speech, I think it was in 1917, I'm not really even sure of that, I have to look up the details, but he made this famous speech in which he said, in which he ended with, you will not crucify labor on a cross of gold. And this was in response to the bankers wanting to keep money completely gold-based, and Bryant was at the time campaigning to have silver added to the monetary base, because he wanted to create a broader money supply, which was indeed very important. And this was not even a very radical measure at the time, really. Yeah? Just adding silver to the money supply is not really what you would say earth-shattering. A few decades earlier, there were the Greenback Wars in the United States, where people were openly clamoring for debt-free government money to be spent in circulation. This famous speech by Bryant was then about creating a more abundant money supply and getting rid of this very scarce gold-based money that was crucifying labor at the time. And this made him a very famous man and the front runner for the presidential campaign a year later.
And you have this article about Hungary, the president The Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, has said he is basically they're not going to join the euro, and he's calling. Are you saying he is actually calling for debt-free money?
Well, that's not really what I'm saying. The article basically commented on another article that spread that really spread like wildfire on the internet, saying that Hungary actually was going debt-free with debt-free money. And this originated from the AFP, but this was not a correct story, and I looked into it, and Hungary is not going to use debt-free money. But what they did do is they paid off the IMF, and they don't want to keep the IMF in the country, which was not to their liking, because they like countries being in debt, obviously, so they can dictate policy. And they were basically kicked out of the country, but that's what actually happened. And the Hungarians also made clear that they were not going to join the euro anytime soon, which obviously also is a very important thing for the Hungarians, because you can see what a disaster that the euro has been for all the other countries that are now encapsulated in this system. And this is all very brave and good by the Hungarian Prime Minister, and he's making a lot of enemies with that.
And he's not a member of the nationalist movement Jobbik, he's actually a member of a mainstream political party.
I think so, yeah. But the public mood in Hungary, obviously, at this point, is very very nationalistic.
Yeah, so even the mainstream is influenced by nationalism. He's nothing like the mainstream politicians in Western Europe or United States.
No, not really. I think he's much more... We must keep in mind, obviously, that Hungary is between the European Union and Russia, and all the states in Central Europe, obviously, are always looking at this difficult position between these great powers, these two great blocs. And I think that Hungary is also encouraged by Putin's policies and surge in international esteem. So perhaps this is inspiring them also.
We can, I guess, conclude the show on the 10 atrocities that would not exist without usury. I mean, the first one is the issue of mass starvation in places like Africa.
Yeah, the poorest countries pay up to 10 times more usury than they receive in development aid. And this is one reason, a key reason, or also a very good example of how usury is simply destroying these countries. And usury hits the poorest the hardest. The poorer you are, the more the larger the part of your income that you will lose to usury. This is what has happened to the poorest countries also. And without the enormous wealth redistribution that is ongoing through usury, there would be no starvation.
And the other one is you have education. Obviously, you have all these people in the United States, and they are $100,000 in debt, and they can't even find work. And this is a really, really big issue.
A really big issue, and it's just indentured servitude, and it's unbelievable how easy all this has become reality. It's just the automatic way with which debt can grow eternally, and people are not bothered, you know. It's incredible, and the ease with which they give away their children to the banks, it's saddening, really.
There's the other one is the issue of Monsanto.
Like we have just been discussing, transnationals would really not exist in a usury-free economy because they would have lost this advantage in lower capital cost, and Monsanto would be a complete non-issue without usury, and it could not exist without usury, and this is one more plague that is just a symptom of the deeper disease.
And there's the issue of ecological destruction, and what happens is when countries, they get into debt, they try to raise the money by plundering natural resources.
Yeah, exactly. And because usury makes investments in the long term more expensive, every year 5%, you know, so the sooner you get rid of the investments, the original investment cost, the better it is. And therefore, all sorts of costs that can be, you know, externalized, as economists call it. This is a very strong driver to pass on these costs, these real costs, on to others and to the future. And to Mother Nature, and this is a crucial driver behind the ever more rapacious plundering of everything that we see, but not just nature, but everything, really, in a broader sense of the word.
And then you talk about the sexualization, and you have this picture. It's spelled like a naked man, and I don't know if it's a woman or a transvestite, whatever they are. They're licking out the ear of the man in that picture.
Yeah, this is the liberty that they give us, this sexual liberation, and we can completely screw our brains out in the most bizarre ways possible, and this then will compensate us for being chained ever more strongly to debt and to usury and to domination by capital and more statist intrusion in our lives and et cetera, et cetera. But hey, we can do whatever we like, even in the public domain nowadays. And you have this mainstreaming also of pedophilia and bestiality, which is now, very much an item, and it's getting worse and worse, and it will only continue to get worse because the powers that we want this to distract us from more serious issues, and they want us to be addicted to all sorts of nonsense. So it's to hinder our spiritual developments, to hinder our focus on each other, and et cetera, et cetera.
And the last one you have is obviously wars, and wars exist because they create debt, and that's pretty obvious, I guess.
All wars are banker wars, as a famous video that recently circulated, and this is a good take. And bankers and usury is behind all the wars, and we all know this nowadays. And it just proves that we really need to get rid of these people. And the only way to do that is to end usury and to get a solid and focused on the normal people monetary system.
So, Anthony Mickles, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.